It's time for a senior moment, the show for and about seniors. I'm Joanne Rideout. I'm here in the studio with Michelle Lewis from Northwest Senior and Disability Services, Doug Schaefer from the Olympic Area Agency on Aging. Together, they represent both sides of the Columbia River. And today, our guest is June Longway. She's with Clatsop Behavioral Health. Today, our topic is depression in older adults. Hi, June. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. Well, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you work and what you do for a living?
I work at Clatsop Behavioral Healthcare. I am a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner, which means I assess, diagnose, and prescribe for mental illnesses. And I've been at CBH for close to 6 years now.
Today we're talking about depression in older adults. Can you start by sort of defining what, you know, everybody gets depressed now and then, but when does depression become a health issue?
Depression becomes a health issue when it begins to interfere with one's ability to function in life. It impedes social relationships, the ability to self-care, the ability to do the things in your life that you need to do to function.
Well, when we think about depression relating to, say, in this context, relating to seniors, would you say that depression is a normal part of aging?
No, it is not. Although that is a fallacy that many people think depression just happens when you get older. And certainly there are many people who do get depressed, but it is not a normal part of aging.
You know, we hear a lot on television about medications for depression and even symptoms of depression. But if we're looking at the elderly population, what does depression look like in that segment of our population compared to, say, a younger person?
Depression is depression, whether you're 6 or whether you're 96. However, there are some things that are more common in the elderly. One thing is that oftentimes depression presents as physical symptoms, buzzing in the head, feelings in the chest, weakness in the limbs, things that have no physical basis and are not really linked to a medical diagnosis, but are very real for the person experiencing them.
Let me ask a little bit of our other two folks in the studio about what you're seeing here in our region. Michelle, can you talk a little bit? You're with Northwest Senior and Disability Services. How much is depression an issue in the people that you serve, that your agency serves?
I think it's probably even a bigger issue than we recognize. One that we do try to be aware that depression could be part of it, especially if we meet a senior who is isolated or maybe have just lost somebody in their family. Maybe they're not taking care of themselves. You know, personal hygiene has gone down. They've disconnected from their families and friends. They're no longer enjoying the things that they used to enjoy. So if we start talking to them and realize that they've kind of cut themselves off and are maybe having a little bit of a tunnel vision, they can't think of things that would make them excited about life again. Then we start exploring that a little bit more, finding out what can we do to help that. So we might start talking about maybe going to the meal site for lunch, joining an exercise class, going to the senior centers, see if we can't activate the idea of, you know, getting out beyond that scope of their smaller now world than it needs to be. Just looking for alternatives for them.
Okay. How about you, Doug? You're Olympic Area Agency on Aging in Washington State. What are you seeing in your clients in terms of depression?
Pretty much the same thing. Isolation is really a biggie because if you're feeling depressed, you do start to sort of draw in. And, of course, that exacerbates it because you're cutting off all the contacts around you. And especially in the senior population, I think, for one thing, as we get older, we have more losses in our life, more family members, more friends, and so on. And, you know, I remember what a shock it was the first time I saw someone my age in the obits, you know, and someone I knew, he's getting up there too.
Yeah, it's not supposed to happen.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's those added losses. There's the distance from family sometimes. You know, their kids have been more mobile. They're across the country someplace. And maybe grandma doesn't have a Skype where she can get on the computer and look at them and talk to them that way. There's also the different sleep cycles that happen as people get older. And especially here in the winter, I've heard family members in my family say, well, it's just always dark. Well, their sleep cycles have changed. So mm-hmm. they're getting up when maybe there's only a few hours left of daylight. And so that really kind of impacts depression, I think, also. Mm-hmm. Plus the people that we also see a lot of depression in the caregivers that are longtime family caregivers, taking care of someone and worrying more about them than themselves. Pretty soon health deteriorates and burdens come up. And I think it's indicative that over the last 10 years or more, almost every assessment tool that we use for family caregivers or for in-home care clients have a depression component that has indicators in it to see if there is mm-hmm. depression there so we can refer and get some help in.
June, let me ask you this next question about differences in depression that we might find in elderly people. Is this some of what they've been addressing?
Well, I think that the increase in losses really can be a trigger for depression that's very real in the elderly population. And as I mentioned earlier, oftentimes people with depression who are elderly will present with physical symptoms rather than saying, I'm sad or I feel depressed. I think, too, that we see sometimes what we can see is late life psychosis, i.e. hallucinations, seeing things or hearing things or delusions, paranoid, like somebody's stealing from me or somebody's moved or somebody slipped into the house. And typically late life psychosis, unless this person has a history earlier in their life of being psychotic, we assume that that is psychotic depression, and treatment with the antidepressants can make a dramatic effect and response in that person. So that's something that we can see also in the elderly that we don't often see in the younger population.
Well, I think, you know, that whole thing of, you know, it's a very complicated situation, because when you have people who are perhaps getting dementia in some way, in addition to depression, then you have the issue of, you know, somebody saying that somebody's stealing from them. Somebody might very well be stealing from them. We've done stories on this show about relatives who are stealing from their elderly relatives. And so then you have a situation where, you know, how do you know whether it's really psychosis or whether it's true? I mean, it can be very murky.
It certainly can be murky, and it requires, very detailed history taking, input from other family members really can be helpful, but it is not easy, and it is a process. It's not like sit down one time, this is exactly what's going on. I think diagnosing is a process, and you look and you see how they respond to different interventions to really determine what the underlying root cause is.
We've talked a little bit about grief and depression, but can you elaborate a little bit more about that? You know, it seems as though that, you know, the older we get, as Doug pointed out, the more likely we are to be grieving about something.
Yes.
Everybody, not just older people.
And certainly in grief, it's very normal to have symptoms that do overlap with depression, loss of interest in life, physical complaints, appetite falling off, sleep disturbance. Those are all a normal part of grieving, and they're also symptoms of depression. But what we don't see in normal grief is suicidal thinking, i.e. I want to kill myself because I just can't live anymore without the person that I've lost. We don't see in normal grief psychosis, the delusional thinking or the hallucinations. We don't see severe loss of self-worth and self-esteem in normal grief. So when these things are going along with the grief, then we have to think about depression.
Well, what do you do with a person who, I mean, we've talked about the issue of consent with adults, where in some shows we've talked about, say, elder abuse, where it's not really quite the same as reporting child abuse, where the person is a minor. Mm-hmm. If the adult doesn't want to report it, then you can't, there's in some cases things you can't do anything about. So what about somebody who's depressed and doesn't want help? Because some people can get, they're so into it that they don't see that they need help. And so what do you do in a situation like that with someone who's an adult?
That's a great challenge. I think that it's helpful if there's someone who does have influence on them to talk with them about the benefits of getting help. Certainly the risk of not getting help is death, whether through stopping eating and physically deteriorating or actually killing oneself, committing suicide. So the risks of depression are very high. And the benefit of getting treatment is that there can be dramatic improvement in one's whole attitude about life, the willingness to live, the interest again in joy in life. So finding someone that can perhaps influence them, presenting to them the pros and cons, addressing the fears and the resistance that they have, what is blocking their ability to seek help, what are they afraid of, can that be addressed and alleviated?
Well, let's talk a little bit about, the topic of suicide, which is a very tragic topic. But I was reading, I remember years ago when I was a junior high teacher, I read that about every 90 seconds a teenager tries to commit suicide in this country. And that was decades ago, so it's probably more now. And I was just reading just a few days ago an article about veterans that in the military suicide attempts are very high. What are the suicide rates? And do you know anything about suicide rates in elderly people as a group, as a demographic?
What I know is that the highest risk group for suicide are white older males. And, of course, males are more inclined to use lethal means, so there's no turning back. When you shoot yourself with a gun or jump off a bridge, it's unlike overdosing where you can make a quick 911 call and get into the ER and get some help. But that is the highest risk group, elderly white males.
So then are you saying that women tend to choose other means?
Yes, women are more likely to choose overdose or cutting on themselves, less lethal means.
Wow. Michelle, let me ask you that. Are you seeing, what kind of issues with suicide are you seeing in your population of people that you're dealing with?
I guess, as we were talking, it's probably a very underreported thing. So we rarely hear of somebody who has died from suicide because you don't hear it reported that way among an elder. It's more of, they quit eating, they quit taking their medications, they kind of slowly died over time. And you rarely hear it reported if somebody's actually shot themselves as a result. So it's not real visible. And so I can't say that, gosh, we see that every month. That's just not true. But we can say that it's very something that we definitely look out for. If we really feel, we're talking to an elder who is talking about wanting to end their life, we just take it seriously. We believe them when they say that. And then we start exploring more and what kind of resources are available for that person. Some people, that's the way they talk. Yeah, I'm going to kill myself. But that's not, we don't underestimate that because we don't know them well enough to be able to say that that's not true. So we start looking for resources at that point. And that's not so unusual to talk to somebody who just is feeling very low, very isolated, very lonely, just lost someone who just, that's what they're talking about, is wanting to end their life. And they may just say things like, well, I won't be here in a year, or I'm sure that I'm not going to be dealing with that later. Or they start giving away things in their life. They start giving away their belongings, walking away from their home, their valuables. And those are all signs that we would definitely be looking for when we talk to somebody that we've just met.
Well, it's a pretty overwhelming thing, too. I mean, it's one thing to have someone who's depressed. It's another thing to have a person who you think might kill themselves. That's a pretty daunting thing for a family member.
Right.
Yes, it is.
To deal at with. Our level, we would just simply want to take action. We'd want to find out what we could do to help that person.
Well, Doug, can you explain a little bit about what you're seeing?
Pretty much the same thing. I mean, we do hear a lot of conversations, especially when they've lost a spouse or something like that, well, I just don't know if I want to keep going, that type of thing. Which you kind of understand as part of that grief process and all of that. But again, more and more of the assessment tools are also sort of zeroing in on, is there any suicidal ideation? Are they talking about suicide? And do they have a plan? And do they have the opportunity and method to do so? Now, I'm not sure about in Oregon, but in Washington State, if one of our case managers are in a home, and that's what they're hearing is that I'm going to do it, Here's how I'm going to do it. I've got the method and I've got the opportunity. We're required by law to stay there until a mental health professional comes. You know, we do hear things like, oh, sometimes I just get so tired of all this, I'm just going to walk into the ocean. And one time I had a family member call, just freaked out because of that. And, you know, I went and talked to the mom and she's just, what? You know, I mean, it's mm-hmm. kind of, but if there, is a, like Michelle said, you're seeing other indicators. They're getting rid of everything. They're not really eating. They're not going out to maybe the congregate meal site or the senior center like they used to. They're just kind of pulling back. And if it is sort of passive and they're just not taking their meds and they're stopping to eat, it that's really slippery. We all have choices. But if it's something more direct and something more sudden and you have some sense of that, then, yeah, you need to get professionals in there.
Hmm. Okay.
Which would be you. So
yes.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about what do you do? We've talked a lot about what the sort of the issue is. Now, what do you do in terms of treating a person with June, let me ask you this, treating a person with depression?
Well, all the research supports that the most effective treatment for depression includes both therapy as well as medications. And medications, we have, since the early 1990s when Prozac came out, we have some excellent medications that are very benign. The list of side effects may be long, but most people don't experience those side effects. And even overdosing on those medications doesn't kill someone. So they're really very safe medications, and they can have profound effect in one's mood, improving it, and making life worth living again.
So what kind of effect, say, would a, what kind of changes would a person taking the medication expect to see? What would it do for them?
Well,
you talked a little bit about it, but what?
Sure. We usually start out with what we call selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And those things include commonly known names, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Celexa, and Lexapro. And these medications take 4 to 6 weeks for the full effect. But within 2 weeks, you're eating better, you're sleeping better, you're just feeling better. And after 4 to 6 weeks, typically, you know, you're looking forward to your day again, and you've got more energy, you want to get out more. You just, life is much better.
So does that speak to the fact that depression is sort of chemical imbalance, which I've read about? Mm-hmm. Is that true? I mean, what is it correcting in the person?
Well, that's a really complicated question, but there are several neurotransmitters that seem to be related to mood, those including serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. And we have antidepressants that hit on all those various neurotransmitters. The SSRIs hit mostly on serotonin, but do affect norepinephrine some also. And these neurotransmitters are in the brain, and low levels can lead to poor mood, low mood. And so, yes, there is definitely a clinical depression involves chemical imbalance in the brain.
So then, is medication like this then a lifetime commitment, or is it a temporary therapy, or both?
That's a great question. If someone has depression the very first time, and then we recommend 8 to 12 months staying on an antidepressant, and then they say, I want to get off meds, I don't want to be on meds the rest of my life, which is a normal, healthy thought. So they come off their meds. If they have depression again, then their risk of depression in the future goes up. So after the third episode of depression, the risk is about 94-96% of relapse. So staying on medications at that time is the recommendation.
Hmm. Okay. So what are some of the I know you mentioned a few names of medication, but what are some of the common, because you're mentioning new ones that were really fairly benign. So what are some of those ones that are I'm just looking, I'll edit some of this out, but I'm just looking for what are names that people might hear if they went to a doctor? What kind of things might they hear the doctor saying, take this?
Some of the medications, a lot of them are now generic, meaning that any pharmaceutical company has the option of making them. They're no longer controlled, patented by one pharmaceutical company. But Prozac or fluoxetine is a very common one. Zoloft or sertraline, Celexa or citalopram, Paxil or paroxetine, and then Lexapro, which I think recently went generic as citalopram. It's sort of the daughter of Celexa, a refined version of the Celexa. So there's also Effexor, which is hits more on norepinephrine than just serotonin, and that's brand name now venlafaxine. So these are long, complicated names, but they all do fairly much the same thing. It's just people will respond better to one than another, and it's somewhat of trial and error type.
Oh, so then there's sort of a process of figuring out what's the best medication for the person, maybe.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, in psychiatry, we can't draw blood and say, this is the medication you need to take. It is some trial and error, but there is a general sense of this type of medication is likely to be helpful in this situation.
Okay. So now, Michelle, and this is a question for Michelle and Doug, that what does a person do who's sitting out there listening to the show and saying, wow, I need help, my family member needs help? When they go to you, what happens? What's they call up Northwest Senior Disability Services, and what's next then?
So we are an information and referral kind of agency for that type of thing. So again, we'd be trying to decipher what they're telling us, how we can help the most, and how we can refer that out. And so if the person's telling us that they may need medical help, then we're going to be referring like to Class of Behavioral Health or to one of our providers in our area for mental health. And if they're just looking for more socialization, we're going to be looking for options for that. Or if they need to, you know, get out, find what's available in our community to help them get out more. Or maybe a daughter wants to bring their mom someplace and get them to a senior center or something. We'd help them find those kind of resources. And we'd make the referrals as necessary. But we're a good place to start. If you just have the questions, you're trying to cipher out what's going on and what might work best, we can at least get them on the trail, the
okay.
place to start.
How about you, Doug?
Pretty much the same thing. We are information and referral. I would encourage people, if it's you're calling about mom and you think she's suicidal, that 911 is the much better number to call, because we're not emergency services in any way. But we can make the connections. We have, through Willapa Behavioral Health, on the other side of the river, we have a program called Geriatric Outreach, where we can shoot a referral to them and they'll send out a geriatric therapist. Just even on a cold call, they'll go just to drop in because someone's concerned, chat with them, kind of get a sense of what's going on, maybe do a depression screening, that type of thing. So that's very helpful. Sometimes people are very offended when he shows up, but sometimes they just, you know, go through the process, or that also gives another set of eyes, and there are more professional mental health set of eyes to say, well, you know, I don't think it's a real problem, or yeah, there's something really going on here. And we'll work side by side with them to gather resources and make connections.
So this kind of treatment, which is really, I guess, psychiatric treatment, does Medicare cover that kind of treatment?
Yes, Medicare can cover
psychiatric meds.
Yeah, depending on what kind of supplementals you've got and things, how much it'll cover. Mm-hmm. But Medicare can cover a percentage of it. If you just have even A and B, it can cover a percentage of it. And then some of your Advantage plans and supplementals will take you further on it. If you have to go to a provider that can bill Medicare, and you need to ask that question before you go.
Okay. So, June, you're with Clatsop Behavioral Health Care. Could people just go directly to you and say, I want to make an appointment with you, or are you someone who is referred, people are referred to you from elsewhere?
Anybody can walk into Clatsop Behavioral Healthcare and get a mental health assessment. And then from there, they are referred for prescription medications or for therapy or for both. So anybody can walk in. We have a crisis worker available 24/7. And during business hours, they can walk in and see a crisis worker if they're in crisis. Off hours, they go to the ER, and a crisis worker will come and work with them, and we'll make referrals from there. Also, primary care providers can make direct referrals for medication assessment, and that way they could skip going through the initial assessment with a mental health therapist and come directly to see a LMP.
Well, I have a question back to your remark about 911, Doug. If you called 911 for about someone who was suicidal, what would they do?
Well, they would go out there and they would assess the situation. Now, again, with the EMTs especially, if there is the mental health element, there are, like you said, there mental health professionals that are on call 24 hours. So they'll come to an ER, they'll come mm-hmm. in. And if EMTs are in a home and go, you know, this is, they'll go there too. Because with the EMTs, if they wanted to, say, transport someone to the ER because they seem disoriented or da-da-da, the person can still absolutely say no.
It's true.
They can't make the determination. The EMTs can't make the determination that this person is incompetent to make mm-hmm. that decision. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's not something we throw out there. You know, the EMTs are coming, but if you don't want to go, just, you know, we don't really throw that out there. But that is their option. They can refuse. And then they have to actually, you know, document that they're refusing to go. But I'm trying to remember the initials, but it's the community mental health professional that's on call 24/7. And they rotate, and so they do go to the ERs, mm-hmm. as was mentioned, and can also come to other places like that when there's imminent danger.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things that I found that I think it's good for people to remember from the show is what Michelle was saying as well about that you should take it seriously. So would you say, mm-hmm. June, that it's not an idle threat in many cases, especially with an older person?
It should always be taken seriously and assessed further and addressed.
Okay. Oh, go ahead, Doug.
Well, I was just going to say, I think this might be very timely for a lot of reasons. I saw a preview on TV for a movie called Side Effects. It's coming out, Jude Law, a lot of big players, and it's about an antidepressant side effect. So you'll be very busy trying to say that was a movie. But I think that's going to bring a lot of people to that point of, well, I don't want to get on antidepressants, mm-hmm. or maybe I shouldn't be on antidepressants. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you always have to, education and information is a biggie.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, we are at the point in the show where I ask everybody to give their contact information. So we're looking at phone numbers, websites, email, things like that. Michelle, how about you?
Okay, so it's Northwest Senior Disability Services, and our office number is 503-861-4200, and our website is nwsds.org.
Okay, and Doug, how about you?
Our Long Beach office is 642-3634, and we're the Olympic Area Agency on Aging. And our Raymond office is 942-2177, and our website is www.03a.org.
And June Longway, our guest, tell us how to get in touch with you.
Clatsop Behavioral Healthcare, and our number is 503-325-5722. And if you Google Clatsop Behavioral Healthcare, you will get to our website.
Okay. So I would urge everybody out there, if depression is a problem for you or someone in your family, to please get the help you need, because the help is out there right in our local area on both sides of the Columbia. You've been listening to The Senior Moment, the show for and about seniors. I'm Joanne Rideout. I've been in the studio today with Michelle Lewis from Northwest Senior and Disability Services, Doug Schaefer from the Olympic Area Agency on Aging, and June Longway from Clatsop Behavioral Healthcare. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you.
For being here, and we'll see you next time on A Senior Moment.